Hello, welcome to our podcast, Rust Belt Science, coming from South Bend, Indiana, on the campus of the University of Notre Dame. I have my co-host here, Shahira Risk. Welcome.
Thank you. Welcome, my co-host, Maggie.
So we are very excited to start this podcast. It's been something Shahira and I have been talking about for a long time.
We have been, yes.
Yes, and here we are doing this together. How long have we known each other now?
Oh, man. I think it was, 2017?
Yes, I think we officially met in 2017. Yes.
Yes, so we're actually we're very grateful for the University of Notre Dame College of Science to be giving us this opportunity to talk about science right here from the heart of the Rust Belt in beautiful South Bend, Indiana.
Yeah. So, Shahira, do you want to tell everyone what you do, where you are? Because you're not working here currently at Notre Dame. So
I am not currently working at Notre Dame, although I did work here for a little bit. But I am now at Indiana University, South Bend. I am a associate professor of chemistry and biochemistry, and basically a giant biochemistry nerd. I love to teach, and I love to do research, and my favorite part is mentoring students to get them to learn how to do chemistry and other things good, too. So why don't you tell us a little bit about you, Maggie, and about what you do now?
Yeah, so like I said, I graduated from Indiana University, South Bend, with a degree in biochemistry. And then I came here to Notre Dame to do my PhD, switched from biochemistry to microbiology. And now I am here as a postdoctoral researcher at Notre Dame. I work in Patty Champion's lab here, and I also am a postdoc in the College of Science, working on science communication and community outreach. So this podcast is a part of that, and I'm very grateful for College of Science letting me do this and bringing you along as well.
That sounds really cool. And you so a postdoc is basically what you do after you get a PhD for most people. And yours is kind of unique. And this is kind of like a pilot project, is my understanding.
Yes.
This is something that not a lot of universities do. So tell us a little bit more about that split that you have between research and science communication, how you see that.
Sure. So like you said, most people, after they finish their PhD, go on to do a postdoctoral research fellowship where they continue to do research in a lab, usually switching labs, usually actually switching universities entirely. But I was also very interested in science communication. I think it is a great responsibility of scientists to communicate well, and not a lot of scientists have the tools to do that. So the opportunity to actually engage in science communication and work with the university to expand how they do science communication was really appealing. So when they approached me about doing a postdoc in the College of Science and kind of creating this position, I was really excited. But I'm also a giant nerd, and I wanted to stay in a lab doing research. I thought it was important if I'm going to be doing science communication, I should also be doing science at the same time. So we came to an agreement with my current boss, Patty Champion, that she would let me work part-time in her lab doing research, and then half of my time will be spent working with the College of Science doing projects like this podcast. So it's not really something that's been done. We're testing it out. I'm a few months in and kind of working out the kinks, but it's been fun. I'm really excited to get to do all my nerd stuff and come here and talk to more people about science as well.
Nerd stuff is super important, and it sounds like a really cool opportunity. And I'm excited that you have this position. Now, tell us a little bit more about the nerd part, the science part. So you work in Professor Patty Champion's lab.
Correct.
And what are you doing?
What I actually do on a day-to-day basis might not be that exciting.
What? Science not exciting? This goes against everything we're telling people.
Sure. I mean, the outcome that you get at the end is very exciting, and there's a lot of fun things that go with it, but it's actually quite monotonous and mundane most days. I think people assume scientists are always in their fancy lab coats with colorful mixtures and, you know, doing all these cool experiments, but it's really actually quite monotonous. There's not really anything colorful either, especially when you work in a microbiology lab, just a lot of tannish liquids, I guess, that smell bad.
So you work in a microbiology lab, so you obviously work with bacteria.
Yes.
Right? And I'm sure you work with certain types of bacteria. So yes. What bacteria are you working on right now or working with or trying to study in Professor Champion's lab?
So in Professor Champion's lab, we study a bacteria called Mycobacterium marinum, which is related to Mycobacteria tuberculosis. So the bacteria that causes TB. So we do work with the TB, but most of the time we're not working with that. We're working with another bacterial species that can still cause infections, but mostly not in humans. Mostly it's a fish pathogen, if I remember correctly. So it's safer for us to work with. So we're really just trying to understand how this bacteria can cause infections and what are some of the factors at play when it decides to be more pathogenic, so cause more serious infections, and kind of the things that happen at the molecular level. So I grow bacteria. I see how it kills red blood cells, how it kills a cell called macrophages. We also have people that will infect fish for us with this bacteria.
Wow.
So there's lots of ways we can test this. So right now I'm really just working with the bacteria to see how well it can break open red blood cells, which is a pretty simple experiment. I guess there's some color there. I get some red.
Yeah, right. Red blood cells.
So unlike other bacteria, M. marinum grows very slowly.
Yeah.
So science takes a little bit longer.
So what are we talking about in terms of slowly here? What's typical for something like, I don't know, a typical lab strain? And how is that different for the strain that you're working with?
So I think most people would be familiar with the bacteria E. coli. We hear a lot about that in the news with food poisoning and things like that. So that bacteria grows pretty quickly. Usually if we started growing in the afternoon, about 18 to 24 hours later, we've got a lot of bacteria that we can work with. So about a day, you can grow bacteria for experiments. M. marinum, it grows about 3 to 4 days. We can have some bacteria, and even then, it's not nearly as much as you get with E. coli. So it just grows a lot more slowly, which has been an adjustment for me since I used to work with other bacteria that grew more like E. coli, grew very fast. So patience. Lots of patients, waiting game, just
waiting
for your
bacteria. It sounds to me like you start the bacteria, let them grow, go to the beach for 3 days, and then come back and do one experiment and say, oh, well, it didn't really work. I need to start it again and then do it again. How does that sound? What do you think?
That would be great.
That would be great.
If that's all I had to do.
If that's all you had to do. So yeah. What else do you have to do?
As a postdoc, there's a lot of other things you have to do, especially a lot of writing, a lot of reading. I guess all scientists do a lot of reading and writing.
That's very true. And also, you're not just a postdoc. You have other things going on in your life.
Yeah, doing this podcast with you now.
Oh, yes. Yeah, that is a thing, right? That is a thing, at least for now.
Hopefully.
We'll see. Hopefully, it'll continue. That sounds really cool. So you're doing this 50-50 split between science communication and the lab research in the traditional sense, and you're studying this bacterium that is very similar to what infects people with TB. So very important work, obviously, because TB is still a pretty big problem worldwide, right? So let's talk a little bit about the science communication work, and you told us a little bit about it. This podcast is part of it. But what other things are you doing with science communication? What do you see is a good way? I'm not going to say the best way. What do you see is a good way to approach science communication? How are we doing it? Who are we communicating it to? And why do it in the first place?
As you know and can relate to, we live in a community that doesn't always have the best relationship with scientists. There's a lot of anti-science ideas. We always use our favorite example of the flat earther that we met.
Yes, flat earth guy.
Yeah. Flat earth guy, yes. When we were bartending together.
That's true. Lovely human being.
Very wonderful. Yeah. And we also have a lot of friends and family who maybe are skeptical of vaccines, yes. of other medical interventions, who maybe think scientists are out to take over the world.
Right.
Or something.
And just for the record, I mean, these are fairly well-educated people, yeah. so we're not saying, oh, they just don't know, right?
It's, right.
And I think this is really where this idea of science communication can really make a difference. I want to be very clear, we're not out there to change anybody's
Correct.
Ideology about
Correct.
Anything. That's not the point. I think if there is a place for us to really be able to first relate to everybody what we do and kind of talk about our humanity, our shared humanity, that's, I think, the first purpose of science communication, is communicating how scientists are human beings. And then after that, we can talk about the science and the details and, you know, the disagreements that scientists have sometimes in the scientific process and how it works, and especially when you're at the very, very forefront of a new discovery or a new technology and we're still not sure how it's going to go and how do we balance, like, things like public safety and privacy and, you know, and preserving people's dignity while being able to innovate and do new things. So those are kind of, I think, some of the goals. And hopefully this is something that we can do with our podcast, that we can try to humanize scientists a little bit. And, you know, as I always say, I, as a chemist, as a biochemist, I know a lot of really great chemists who are just terrible human beings.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not people that I would like to be friends with. They're not mm-hmm. people that I'd like to hang out with or even work with. And that tends to be the case in any job, in any profession that you have. I've dealt with electricians who were just wonderful people and electricians who were not so wonderful. I'm not picking on electricians, but, you know, same goes with photographers, the same goes with opera singers, the same goes with everybody, right? I was just picking out all my friends.
I know, those,
and their
I'm like, those are all your friends.
I have like three friends, and that's them.
The opera singer, the photographer, and the electrician.
That's
Sounds
basically
like a good book.
It. Yeah, yeah, right. So, Maggie, why don't you tell us a little bit more about how you see the role of science communication, maybe how it relates to what this podcast will be about?
I think as scientists, we're not really trained to communicate to people outside of our field of expertise. And so when something like COVID happens, where science becomes prominent in, you know, public discourse, scientists aren't very good at explaining what's going on. And people, like we just talked about with what I actually do in the day in the lab, people don't know what scientists actually do and what we're able to make claims about and things like that. So, you know, scientists get up there and start talking and the public is confused. They might already have some distrust of scientists because scientists can get things wrong. So I think we're kind of entering this era, especially with so much information online that people can have access to, where scientists need to be more adept at explaining not only the science, but connecting with people on a more human level. Where we've talked about this before, where scientists were trained to not really think like humans and to remove a lot of our human instincts and just think about data, numbers, graphs. And that doesn't translate when we go out and talk to people who haven't had that same type of training. And we're not really able to appeal to the human side of people. That, you know, with vaccine hesitancy, as an example, the motivation behind somebody being hesitant to get a vaccine for their children is because they want their child to be safe.
Yes.
And as scientists, we know vaccines, you know, actually make children more safe.
Right.
And there are potential risks and side effects, and I think we should be honest about those when those come up. But rather than just giving people a pamphlet of information appealing to this idea that we all want to keep our children safe. And I think as scientists, we're very bad at doing that. And I think that's a starting point of science communication, is how can we begin to interact with our communities and the people around us in a way that treats people with dignity. And on top of that, getting people excited and curious about science and seeing it not as this thing that we use to make policies to make people's lives harder or more difficult, but something that is just full of endless discoveries and things that nobody could have ever imagined we could see. I mean, when I look under my microscope in my lab and see bacteria moving around, I'm like, I'm the only one that's ever seen this. That's crazy. I'm the first one to see this. And that's a really exciting thing as a scientist. And I think that's why most scientists go into science.
Right.
Because it is fascinating. I didn't go into science because I want to, convince people to get vaccines.
Shocking.
I just like school and I like science and like to learn. And I think if we can instill that same sense of wonder in people, not just children, we talk about this a lot. I think this is a podcast for adults who are curious as well and want to see science in a more human light. And hearing from people who are actually doing the science, I think can really help people get excited and then also trust scientists that we're just nerds. We're not out here to, we don't have time or energy because science takes so much work. You know, we're just trying to get the next paper published, trying to get the next grant funded, which is exhausting. And that already takes away from the creativity and curiosity of science. So I think that's what this podcast is hopefully meant to do is, you know, between the two of us, and any guests that we can have on here to talk about their research as well, is just make something more accessible to people who might be curious and also show that we're humans and we do things outside of science. We, you know, we were talking about what we were watching and listening to before this podcast. And, you know, I watch reality TV.
Excellent.
And you watch a lot of YouTube.
I watch a lot of YouTube, yes.
So those are things that everyone can relate to, and I don't think as scientists we're allowed to really showcase the whole breadth of who we are as humans. Yeah. So that's really the goal here. And I it's worked in other areas of interacting with people on the more individual level and even in smaller communities. This approach seems to get people to engage with scientists and to trust them and to see them as members of their community and not outsiders.
This sounds like a great podcast.
I love podcasts.
So myself. I mean, this is from an unbiased point of view here. This sounds great. Well, I just want to touch on a couple of things that you said here in terms of science communication and the training of scientists. You know, but a big part of what we do is we give presentations, we write papers to communicate what we do. But that usually goes to other scientists. And there's almost like this other language that we speak of. In fact, my sister, who's also a scientist, she went to give a practice talk at a conference. And, you know, before to check the sound and video and everything is working properly. And the person who is doing the audio videos told her, basically, I did not understand a single word of what you said. But most of the people in the audience could really follow the story that she was telling. And she was telling a story. And she's actually a very good public speaker. But it's like a different language. Even though we're speaking English, it is a different language. So tell us a little bit more about this whole, like, untraining the scientist to be able to speak human language as opposed to science language, which I don't want to make them like they're opposite to each other.
Right.
But I'm talking about something that's a little bit more accessible so that more people can actually understand or relate to it, maybe see the importance, and I think more importantly than the importance, to be able to see the passion there and to kind of trigger curiosity. So how are we doing that and how do we plan to do that?
Well, I think I think this phrase is a little bit overused, but I think it's appropriate here is telling stories. Mm-hmm. And, you know, even when you are writing a scientific paper or presentation, you are creating a story. So it's not a new idea that scientists are trying to create a narrative and convince people. We're just trying to convince other scientists why our data should be believed.
That's true.
Which turns out to be really difficult sometimes. Yes.
As it should be.
Yeah.
As it should be.
It should be rigorous and we want our data to be challenged. So we're sure of it. But when it comes to presenting, you know, if we want to present the same information that we would publish in a journal to the general public, we can't just give them a bunch of graphs and data. And I think thinking more narratively about science is something that has proven to be effective. We know that from a lot of communication research that using these storytelling models can help people understand and engage. But I think even that falls short in some ways, and it's really difficult as scientists to really play and have fun with the stories. I mean, some of the data that I've gotten is so cool and so wild, and the stories you can tell with it without compromising the science is just not something that's encouraged a scientist to do.
That's a very important point. I think oftentimes you see scientists get wrapped up in the experiment, in the frustration of things not working, that we tend to, and the day-to-day, you know, just watching bacteria grow, you know, that might not sound like the most exciting thing for 99.99% of the people on the planet. But sometimes we get wrapped up in how mundane things get, and the pressure to publish, the pressure to, you know, perform well in any situation you have, whether you're teaching, you're doing research, you're, you know, at conferences, you're writing grants, and your livelihood is on the line every time you're applying for grants, and not just your livelihood, but maybe the people that are working under you as well, because you have to fund them. And I think that's not a very well-known fact. But the point here is that this frustration kind of gets to us, and oftentimes we forget why we got into science in the first place. That excitement kind of wanes, or maybe not wanes, but it just kind of is hiding under the pile of stressful things that you have to deal with.
Yeah, I would say it's even sometimes actively discouraged.
Yes, and that's the point that you were making. It's even actively discouraged. Like, you know, behave yourself, control your emotions. Science is not about emotions, right? Don't get too excited. It's not very, what's the word? It's not very becoming of you, young lady, right? As they say.
Not very demure.
Not very demure. Control yourself, young man, right? But you know me, and I like to get really, really silly when I give presentations.
Yes.
And I think that speaks to people, because that silliness, that passion, that love for science, I always try to go back to that place, mm-hmm. even when I'm most frustrated with mm-hmm. whatever results or whatever the job has. Mm-hmm. You don't ever want the job to take away from what the job is all about, mm-hmm. because then it defeats the purpose. And I think there's kind of a general tendency. You see these famous scientists, and when a lot of them, not all of them, but a lot of them, when you see them talk and give talks, they're still so excited. They act like children. And it's such a fun thing to watch. And I think that's mm-hmm. that's kind of what sets them apart, is just mm-hmm. that playfulness that is really the basis of discovery, is mm-hmm. playing and playing systematically. Mm-hmm. And we were talking yesterday about making the right mistakes
mm-hmm.
and exploring and just, you know, futzing around with stuff, I guess.
I think scientists remembering that they are humans and showing other fellow humans that we are human. And
it's like, trust me, I'm a human.
Yeah. Like, I like to have fun. I like to be silly. I am curious about things, because I think we also, when we're talking about the people we're trying to communicate to, we talk about them as if they are stupid, that they are not curious, mm-hmm. that they are, you know, just these people that we look down on. And I think it's actually the opposite, and we're really doing a disservice to people when we approach it that way. Like you say, just give them the data, and they'll understand. And if they don't understand the data, then they're just stupid.
Yes, it's like, if I just tell them how it works, then they'll just figure it out and they'll believe exactly what I believe.
And if they don't, then they are incapable of that. But I think the people I've talked to in my life who do hold some of these ideas that are anti-science, they're incredibly curious people. That's why they have gone out and sought out their own information.
Agreed.
And they are not stupid. They're very intelligent people, mm-hmm. and they are just motivated by something that us as scientists are trained not to be motivated by.
This is like a whole podcast episode I think we can do. And just I think it's really important to really talk about and to address the ideas of conspiracy theories and why people are attracted to it. And mm-hmm. I think that would be a really fabulous show.
Yeah.
We should, how about that?
Let's make that. Let's write it down.
But I just want to go back to this idea of just playing around as scientists, you know, just doing things for fun. So I'm going to ask you, what do you do for fun, Maggie?
Well, as you know, right now, I am raising ducks.
I know.
I've shared my duck eggs with you a few times.
Delicious, yes.
So that's kind of my hobby right now outside of science is... I think I've got.
Yeah, I was gonna ask. Can you give us a number on the number of ducks?
I think I've got 15 right now.
15.
I think.
Wow.
15. Yeah. Lost a couple of them to an owl a couple of weeks ago. Butchered a few of them. So we were down a few, and then I got 9 babies right now. So that is my kind of life outside of science right now is wake up. Let the ducks out, feed the ducks, watch them play in the water.
Sounds lovely.
Come home.
Yell at the kids.
Yell at my kids.
Yeah.
And then go hang out with the ducks some more. And I find it to be really, you know, as they say sometimes, touch grass. It's my way to go out and touch grass and stay grounded in the fact that I live in here. I don't live in a lab. And so that's really fun. Just sitting outside in my backyard. I also garden, but the ducks destroyed the garden. So that's no longer a current hobby. So, yeah, my ducks, my lovely, beautiful babies.
That's wonderful.
So what about you? What do you do for fun, Shahir?
I feel like everything I do is fun. I am spoiled. Well, I am very, very spoiled. I am very lucky to love almost every aspect of my job. I do a lot of teaching, being at a place like IU South Bend.
But you got to answer something that's not related.
Oh, not related to science.
Like, what do you do that's fun?
Yeah, totally misunderstood the question, right?
Yeah,
I just fail.
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 Yeah,
epic fail.
I know you love your job. That's why you do
it. Okay, all right, fine.
What do you do when you're not?
I play soccer. Yes. Every Sunday with my friends, and it is such a wonderful chance to just kind of turn off my mind and use my body to push down my friends in a very friendly, competitive way, and then we laugh about it later. I watch some soccer, too, whenever I get the chance to, right? Premier League. I'm not going to say who my favorite team is because it's very embarrassing.
But it is, I know, and it is embarrassing.
Yeah, let's just skip over that sore topic. We still want to keep it fun.
It's Chelsea.
Stop. We still want to keep it fun. And I also do a lot of art whenever I can. And you know this very well because we both are artists as well. So art is a big, big part of my life. It's always been a big part of my life, and it's always been something that's been encouraged by my parents. Even though, you know, I knew early on I was going to be a scientist, pretty much.
This is true, yeah.
But art was always a big, big part of my life. I am taking a printmaking class right now
at
the wonderful South Bend Museum of Art. And it is such a great time to be able to just focus on making art. And, of course, I'm making these prints of protein structures because what else am I going to do? But also a bunch of whales and crows and other cool images from nature. So art and soccer and just hanging out with my boys.
Yeah, you got two boys. I got two boys.
That's true. I have two teenagers or almost teenagers, a 12-year-old and a 16-year-old, and we just hang out and do whatever dumb stuff. They show me all the new things that the internet has to offer. And I try to have the mind to understand it, and I fail miserably, but it's just so much fun to see it.
Yeah, your kids are super cool, super smart. Mine, I have a 13-year-old and an 11-year-old. They're not as cool as your kids.
They are super cool. Your kids are super cool and super smart.
They just show me dumb internet videos. They don't show me, like, cool things.
That's what I do. I'm talking about cool, dumb internet videos. Yeah. It's all memes, right? That's all memes. So
yeah,
I think we're in the same boat.
Yeah, we can relate to scientists and his parents of two basically teenage boys.
I think that may have been one of the first things we were relating on.
Yeah.
Like, oh, yeah, you have two boys. I have two boys. Of course, they were much younger at the time, so much more of a handful. And I think you recognize the pain in each other's eyes, right? And the joy, too. Right?
Yeah.
They're wonderful.
Yeah. Well, you said something about art, and I want to go back to it real quick because I think that's another component of science communication that we both are very passionate about and have been and really started our science communication work is art. You said you were doing prints of protein structures.
Yes.
First of all, can you maybe explain a little bit about what a protein structure is and how you can actually even make a print of that?
Oh, boy. Yeah, of course. I think you pushed the button.
What button?
My button to start talking about science.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That's
well,
it.
I talked about bacteria, which are cool, but for both of us, proteins are, that's the thing.
That is the thing. And, you know, proteins are basically what I've spent most of my scientific life studying. Proteins are delicious, as we all know, right? So if you're eating a hamburger or if you're eating baked beans or whatever it is, they're very delicious. So these are all protein-rich foods.
Mm-hmm.
But the reason why we need proteins is because we make our own proteins. So we take the proteins that we eat, we break them down, and then we build our own proteins because proteins basically do almost everything that we need. Mm-hmm. So they are essentially the worker bees of the cell. So anything that needs to be done, whether it's cleanup, digesting your food, moving your muscles, transporting oxygen from your lungs to the rest of your body, storing oxygen, you know, a lot of hormones are proteins, like insulin, for example, that's a protein. So proteins are like, they do almost everything. I'm not going to say everything because then the RNA and lipids and sugar people are going to be really upset.
I don't
want to
make them upset.
Don't want to make RNA people upset.
No.
And but proteins really do almost everything. And what's cool about them is that they have these shapes that look like almost like abstract art.
Mm-hmm.
They look like Celtic knots in some cases. Mm-hmm. They have these little spirals that we call helices. And they have these really cool structures, three-dimensional structures. Mm-hmm. And it's the three-dimensional structures that make them do the job that they have. It's kind of like, you know, a chair has to have a certain three-dimensional structure for you to be able to sit on it. If it's not a chair, you know, if it doesn't look like a chair, it's probably not something you want to sit on.
Mm-hmm.
And so proteins also have these structures, and they're really cool. They do amazing things. And in my research, what I like to do is take proteins that are naturally existing, whether they're from bacteria or from humans or whatever, and change them a little bit, make some mutations, if you will, change them a little bit so that they do new things that they've never done before.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always been fascinated with protein structures ever since I saw them as a college student and never really turned back. I mean, I just wanted to know how they work, what they do, and how can we make them do other things that nature has never seen before. And so just that fascination with the structure, and I think that a lot of people in the world can look at or imagine what that double helix, DNA, looks like. I think we're a lot more familiar with something like DNA, the genetic code, the double helix. We can imagine that. We know it's just the spiral staircase, right, the double staircase or the twisted ladder kind of thing.
Yeah.
And we know that DNA is made up of a bunch of genes, right? And genes are obviously important in inheriting all the different things that we have, our eye color, hair color, but even our propensity to developing different diseases. But most people kind of that the knowledge, there's a kind of a bit of a knowledge gap of what do these genes actually do? Well, genes are really the code that helps our cells make proteins because it's the proteins that ultimately do whatever it is that we do, whether, you know, it has to do with hair color or hair structure. You know, I have curly hair, and you know that has to do with the proteins that are coded by the genes that I inherit from my parents, and so on and so forth. Type of insulin that we make, if we have a defect in it, all of those things are on the protein level. And DNA has kind of a very well-known structure. It does take on different structures, but it's fairly limited. But proteins have diverse levels of structure. And I think they just look really cool. Mm-hmm. And I want to kind of bring that out to, you know, just share the joy of looking at these things. Mm-hmm. And so I've been playing around with making prints that incorporate images of protein and why they're important to us as humans, but also to animals, plants, bacteria, fungi, whatever it might be.
Yeah, proteins are great.
I told you, you pushed the button and I just couldn't stop.
I know.
Yeah, I could probably talk for hours.
I would talk to you for hours about proteins, but I want to make sure that I follow up that lovely explanation of why you think art is a good way to communicate some of these really complex and sometimes abstract ideas. Yes. in biology and biochemistry. And how have you done that? And why do you think that's an important part of our science communication goals here?
Right. So art is extremely important because, at least for me personally, I feel like it was art that brought me to science in many different ways. So just the visual aspect of it, like cells under a microscope, I think that's beautiful. It's a beautiful work of art. It really is. And then you look at protein structures, the same thing. I love the three-dimensionality of everything. Everything just has depth to it. But also, okay, different forms of art here. Mm-hmm. But one of the main reasons why I became a scientist was a TV show. And, of course, we know that TV shows are a form of art. Mm-hmm. And this was MacGyver back in the 80s. How he could get himself out of trouble by manufacturing something and just using science. He's also a pacifist. And it's just, you know, he played hockey. And it's just such a cool guy.
Yeah.
You know, with that mullet,
amazing.
Right?
Oh,
the
gosh,
of course, yeah, right. And so...
Bring that back.
I know, bring that back, right? Right. And so just the idea of using science to kind of... overtake the bad guy or to get yourself out of a tough situation was just so attractive to a 10-year-old or a 12-year-old. Mm-hmm. And it was communicated in that art form, not to mention just reading about science in more narrative ways. Mm-hmm. I think that's very important because it really relates it to it. Science, I don't think it was ever meant to be dry. But we go out of our ways as scientists to make it dry when we communicate it to other scientists because we just want to cut to the chase. Because, and this is for a very good reason,
right?
If I feel a certain way about the data, well, that's not appreciated very much because we really have to let the data speak for itself.
Yeah, it's not scientific.
It's not very good science to say, well, I feel that I'm right.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean that we feel good when things work and that we feel bad when things don't work. We feel frustrated when the feelings are part of it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we know that we can only separate ourselves from our experiments only so much.
Mm-hmm.
And there's always going to be different interpretations, right? Most of the time, it's pretty cut and dry. You know, 99% of the data are telling you one thing. You know, that 1% is not going to be highly likely. But the feelings part, I think, translate much, much better when we use different forms of art, whether it's visual arts, whether it's theatrical arts, whatever it might be. The mm-hmm. narrative storytelling arts, like you mentioned earlier, all of these can help us relate. And I think we're relating on a human level,
mm-hmm.
if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think art has a very powerful way of evoking emotions from people. And I think it's okay to have emotions about science. Hopefully good emotions, wonder, excitement.
Yeah, it's curiosity. Okay. It's okay to cry.
Yeah, it's okay to cry.
It's okay
science.
To cry when your experiments don't work, when your grant doesn't get funded.
Yeah. I think using art to explain, like I said, these really complex ideas, I don't think the goal is to get the, you know, general public, whatever that means, to fully understand protein folding and, you know, protein engineering. I mean, that'd be great if they did.
Well, we also don't understand all of it. I think it's clear. Yeah,
to really get people to have an openness about the idea that science is a process and the results can change as we get new information.
Right.
and to really just get them to engage with it in a, you, what do you always say, fostering fascination.
Fostering
and I think
fascination, yeah.
Art is a good way to do that because you're not so much worried about, you know, the p-values or whatever, how
yeah,
significant this is. You're just trying to evoke some type of response from the people who are viewing it. And I think visual art, especially with, you know, we can see a tree. We know what a tree looks like.
Right.
Nobody has ever seen a protein unless you've been in a lab that does protein, you know, structure solving. So using art, I think, is really powerful to get people to see things that we can't see with our own eyes, as opposed to a tree, a fish, which are beautiful.
Yes, and that's true. I think it's easy to talk about trees and fish, things that we known and have seen ever since we were babies, children. We knew even before we learned the words for them,
mm-hmm.
right? But then when you talk about things like DNA, genes, proteins, you know, lipids, cell membrane, bacteria, that mm-hmm. things that we have never really seen until we're older, and maybe some people live and die without even learning about them.
Yeah.
That's a little bit harder to get across.
Mm-hmm.
So what are we doing about it, Maggie?
Well, we both have been making lots of science art.
For sure.
In our spare time.
Right.
What else have we been doing?
We've also been writing about it.
Oh, yeah. We do a lot of science writing.
Science writing as well.
Yeah, we have I guess this is our shameless plug.
Shameless plug time.
We're gonna shameless plug.
Shameless plug time.
We have a book coming out
Woo-hoo!
This spring.
In the spring of 2025.
Yes. What is the title of this book, Shahir?
The Color of North. Dun, dun, dun.
The Color of North.
Yes.
This will be coming out with Harvard University Press.
Excellent.
And this book, we started writing this in 2019, I think.
I think so.
Yeah.
That's when we started working.
So
on it. Yeah.
It's a book about proteins.
Of course.
Of course.
Of course.
And there is also, we illustrated it ourselves.
That's correct.
Drawings of protein structures. Mm-hmm. And the book is really, it's a pop science book. It's for a general, you know, reader. You don't have to have a scientific background to understand it. But we really relied heavily on the art and the storytelling. It's very narrative driven. So we each write about personal experiences and tie those into the proteins that play a role in those experiences that we have. For example, you talk a lot about memories
mm-hmm.
And write about how your memories can be triggered and then talk about the molecular mechanisms that make those things happen, which
That's
is super
true.
Cool.
So, that was a wonderful shameless plug.
Thank you.
Oh, excellent.
Hopefully our editor is happy with that. But all that to say,
we can have an entire episode about how to not write a book.
So all that to say, science communication is something that we've been doing for almost as long as we've known each other and started working together, collaborating on different ideas. We've done a lot of other things here and there. And really it's grounded in treating people with dignity mm-hmm. and appealing to the human side of who we are as scientists.
Correct.
And using maybe non-traditional methods to communicate those scientific ideas.
I love it.
I think it's going. And then now this podcast. Which
and now
is,
this podcast.
Is, you know, mm-hmm. we've spent a very high number of hours, you and I sitting having these conversations with no microphones or recording.
That's true.
So this is an opportunity for you listeners to kind of hear what scientists talk about, which can range. We have a wide range of things we can talk
Soccer,
about.
Ducks.
Soccer, ducks.
Proteins.
Proteins.
Deadlines.
Deadlines. So I think that pretty much sums up kind of what we want to say for this kind of first episode, I think this will probably be so.
And hopefully we'll have some really cool people
yes.
that we can interview to help us explain their science to us
yes.
and to you, our wonderful listener.
Because let me tell you, just because we are scientists does not mean that we understand all science.
What?
I know. I know. It's shocking.
Shocking.
But there is a lot of things I don't know about. Just because we have PhDs does not mean
that we know everything.
That we know everything.
Yeah.
Or that we can, or that we don't have to work hard to understand other complex topics. Like magnetism and electricity. That's magic. I don't understand.
Electricity is magic. I don't understand it as a biologist. I passed my physics classes. You know, I think I memorized some of the problems. And that's about it. But not to say that it's not cool. It's super cool. It is super cool. But it's just because we have our PhDs doesn't mean that we understand everything. I still think magnets are a work of spirits.
Yeah.
Not literally, of course.
I'm going to stand by it, literally. I do not understand it.
Man.
So, yeah, I think hopefully we have more cool things coming.
I hope so, too.
We have a long list of people we'd love to have on and share with you guys. And I think we podcast it.
Let's do it. And thank you to Notre Dame for making this happen.
Yeah, thank you.
All right. At the end of our show, we would like to thank you, our lovely listeners, and our awesome audience for spending your time with us. We thank the Notre Dame College of Science and the Indiana University South Bend College of Arts and Sciences. Special thanks to the wonderful people at the Notre Dame Studios. Coming to you from beautiful South Bend, Indiana, in the heart of the Rust Belt, this is Rust Belt Science. I'm Shahir Risk.
And I'm Maggie Fink.
And we'll catch you next time.